Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking today about how to keep your computer and data from being compromised while you travel. And our guest, Jesse LeGrew, is back with us, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. We'll talk about how you can use Wi-Fi and Bluetooth safely in public places. And, of course, we'll take your other related questions as well. Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jesse LeGrew, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Happy to be here.
You know, I'm one of these people, when I go to the airport, I want to get there early. And it's usually a couple hours early, much to the chagrin of my daughter sometimes when she's traveling. But when I get there, the first thing I think about is my phone. And you always worry a little bit about how safe it might be in the airport or any other public place. That have free public Wi-Fi. How safe is it?
Well, part of it is really being certain of what you're even connecting to, which can be a challenge, especially in a large public location. Even though, for example, a network name that you might see on your device matches what is publicized otherwise for their wireless network, it is a possibility. It could be a rogue third party, somebody else that had set up an access point, potentially to allow you to connect to it and try to look at your data. So I'm always a bit suspicious of just about any wireless in any public location, especially if it's not encrypted, which most of the times, free public Wi-Fi, you might not have a password. You might be able to connect. There might be a accepting terms of service web page that pops up that you check a box and hit submit. It really helps to make sure you can connect and you know what rules might be there, but it could be somebody else's Wi-Fi service that you might be able to connect to, and they could be trying to read the information that you're transmitting over the internet. So I'm a bit suspicious about all of them, even if they do look legitimate, just because it's a very large location, especially in an airport, to keep track of, to really understand whether there are rogue access points around. And there are some, you know, technologies that help out with that. But it's kind of a daunting task when you think of a large international airport, especially, that could be, you know, a large geographic area, and doesn't just impact even the terminals or where you might check into a flight. There's just so many locations it could be, when some of these airports can, you know, stretch over miles. So, you know, it's always a concern, but the one recommendation I usually have for anyone is, if you are connecting to a public wireless network, use something like a virtual private network or a VPN that you can turn on when you need it to, you know, lessen the risk that somebody is going to be able to look at what you're doing. I've actually been really lucky most of the time where, if I have my cell phone, most of the time my data plan works and I actually don't even need to connect to wireless. And if you're in that situation, great. You don't even need to connect to wireless. Only if you really need to, would I recommend connecting to wireless when you do use a VPN. But also, you know, keep in mind of what websites you're accessing. If you don't need to access a sensitive website like your bank, wait.
Wait.
So that'll help minimize that risk as well.
And you mentioned VPN, and Jack in Duluth, Minnesota has a question about VPN. So let's go there. Jack, hi. Thank you for calling. Jack, are you there? Hi, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Larry. And thank you for taking my call. I think we lost me there for a moment. I would like to know in very simple terms, because I'm a very simple person, what a VPN is and how I would, what is a VPN and how would I put it on my laptop or my cell phone?
Okay. Good questions.
Yeah, and a VPN or virtual private network is kind of your own private connection to the internet, we'll say. So in theory, it's something that no one can reach inside, read any of the data that's going between you and whatever website that you're going to. It's your connection that's private, which is the biggest thing. So it lessens the chance somebody can peer into what you're doing and get that information. And there's a variety of ways to get a VPN. There's a lot of free services. There's also a lot of paid services. Usually when you pay for a service, you're going to get a few extra features. Maybe you'll have more devices you can use at one time. Maybe you'll have faster VPN service, which if you're just accessing web pages, it may not be a large need. Or you might have the capability to access different countries, which for some people, they like doing that for a variety of reasons, including for streaming content and other services like that. A lot of the free VPN services work out for a majority of individuals. Usually all it takes is signing up for their service, which usually just requires an email. You might not require any other payment information. And you'll have a client you can download and install. Sometimes they're actually built in. So if you have a Mac, we can often use the built-in VPN client that's comes with your operating system. In other cases, you might have to download a client and install it. And usually, most of those are relatively straightforward. You install the client, you sign in with the account that you created, and you hit connect. And once you connect, it'll tell you, hey, by the way, you're on your VPN connection. And you'll usually see on the top of your screen, top right, top left, some indicator that says you are connected to your virtual private network, which, your data is secured. No one should hopefully be able to snoop in on that information. If you are using a mobile device, you're usually going to see an app available either in the App Store if you're using an iOS device, or it might be the Google Play Store if you're using an Android. And whatever service that you go to, they're usually going to have it on their front page, or as soon as you sign up, you'll get an email. Here's how to install your clients, and here's how you go ahead and connect. So it's really a straightforward process. You don't necessarily have to pay for it. But if you want a little bit faster speed, if you want to be able to connect to different countries and utilize internet services from a different country, paying a little bit extra might be a benefit. But for most users, that free VPN service is going to be a great benefit. And it's usually a really, really easy to get that client installed and turn it on.
And now, does that then automatically run all the time for you, Jesse?
Usually not. A lot of the services will have an option if you do want to turn it on. In some cases, especially for the free VPN services, you might be limited in terms of how much data you can use, how long it can be turned on, or how many devices that you can have connected at one time. And just based on that, it's usually a turn it on when you need it, turn it off when you don't. But by default, if you reboot your computer, if you turn off and turn on your phone, usually it's not going to connect automatically. It's only those times when you need that service available that you would go ahead and turn it on. So it, when I go to a public area and I connect to Wi-Fi, if I do need to use a public wireless, at that point, I will go to my VPN, turn it on, and then as soon as that's completed, I'll go ahead and do whatever else I need to do.
And somebody else is wondering, where do I find it in my iPhone?
In your iPhone, there will be settings underneath the general preferences wheel or gear. And once you get to that, you'll actually see a VPN option on the left-hand side. It's going to have a button to just turn it on or turn it off. But it may have no what they call VPN profiles attached. And usually that's when you go to your VPN provider. Once you follow their instructions, you might have an option in there you can simply turn on to turn on the VPN, but they might also have a client. And each VPN service is going to be a little bit different, but usually on an iOS device, you're going to see it right in that preferences gear under the VPN options. But you're probably going to have to set up a VPN before they show up there.
Got it. Thanks again for that question. Appreciate it. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Bluetooth connections to cell phones are handy in a lot of ways and allow people to use wireless headphones, and you've got hands-free calling in cars. How can Bluetooth put personal information at risk?
Yeah, and Bluetooth is kind of it's an example of what they call a personal area network. So it's kind of your own private little network that you have for a variety of devices that might be close to you. Could be a keyboard, could be earbuds, and it could be a variety of other devices. You know, part of the danger, if anyone is able to tap into that information and read the data, is really what's ever transmitted through that information. So for example, if you're using a keyboard over Bluetooth and you're typing in passwords or typing in sensitive information, if there was a way for somebody to capture that information and decode or decrypt it, maybe they'd have information that you were typing from a keyboard. Usually there's protections in place if you're using newer devices that would make it extremely difficult for that to happen. In addition, Bluetooth is over a short range. So if somebody really wanted to get that information, they'd have to be relatively close to you in order to do that. Usually it's gonna be a few meters. It's not going to be something where someone a block away is going to be able to try and attack that Bluetooth connection. They'd be pretty close to you. You'd probably see them if they're actually trying to do it, unless they had some kind of specialized device. So it can be a risk, but the nice thing is Bluetooth is usually over a short range. As long as you're pretty careful about you know, what's around you at the time, it's probably less of a concern. But most people are also listening via earbuds for other services. Maybe it's a podcast. It's probably less concerning to me if listening to the podcast that I'm listening to. If you are using other voice services or even services from third parties, so let's say it's FaceTime or if it's Skype, a lot of those connections are going to be encrypted anyway. It's not going to be something that... at least through the device and the service will be encrypted. You know, that audio might be a little bit different coming from your phone to the earbuds. But once again, they're going to have to be really, really close. So it's a danger. In a high security environment might be more of a concern, but I think for normal day-to-day consumers, it's usually pretty safe. And when you are connecting Bluetooth devices, they usually require a code to confirm that it is the device you're wanting to connect to. So, you know, when you are in an area where you don't need Bluetooth, I'd actually recommend turning it off. It just makes sure that you're not trying to connect to other devices, no other devices are trying to connect to you. And you're going to see that on a variety of devices. Usually just have that little Bluetooth icon. You can click on it, it'll turn it off, and you don't have to worry about it. And that can be, you know, extra precautions if you are concerned about it.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Maria Lopez, our engineer. Clara Neipert, our producer. David Edgerton will be up next. But in the meantime, you, my friend, are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network, taking a look at your computer and software. We've zeroed in a bit on security today, but taking other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take Dave and Edgerton next. Dave, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
I'm wondering if your guest knows any way to record a phone call on an Android phone, you know, once the call has been established, and then save the file and download it to a desktop or laptop computer.
It's a really good question. I actually have not... done this in the past. So at least when taking a look at Android devices and looking up some Google documentation, there is an option in settings for call recording. It is not something that I've used myself, but I'm actually going to try to take a look here to see if I can even find that. a call recording could be an option if you are using the built-in features for the Google Phone. Another option, which is a little bit different, if I were trying to record a phone call, and granted, in this case, depending on what you're recording, I would keep in mind, be aware of your local laws. Wisconsin is, I believe, a dual consent state. So you actually need consent from both parties in order to record a phone call, to my knowledge. So just be aware of any local laws. If it is legitimate in order to be able to do that, you could also use speakerphones and just plain other recording equipment to record the phone call over speakerphone. But it is probably going to depend on device to device on what options are available. You probably could also get a third-party application through the Google Play Store. Google Voice also has its own option when using it, but they also have the phone by Google. So it might depend on the exact options you have on your Android device and how updated it is, and whether you're using a different third-party option. And you can get, some third-party apps in order to do it. And I'm looking up a few here, which could be options. But the biggest thing is I would probably, get advice depending on what you need to do from a lawyer, just to make sure it's legal, because I know that is a concern in a variety of states with different laws, and it might be illegal unless the other party knows that you are recording that phone call. But there are third-party applications you can download from the App Store. If you are using the Google services, you might actually be able to just hit the call recording button that's available as an option when you're in the call itself. Otherwise, the very potentially easier way, if you just have a different recorder, is hit speakerphone and then try to pull the recording from another device that you might have physically close. And it could be a laptop, it could be, an analog or digital recorder that you could otherwise use just for other voice conversations.
There you go, Dave. Thank you so much. Wisconsin is a one-party consent state. I just learned from Clara, so there you go. Thank you again for calling. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Mike in Milwaukee, he called but couldn't stay with us. He wonders, how do free VPN services make money?
It's another good question. So a lot of the free providers will also have paid services. So one way they probably generate revenue is actually for the individuals that need more of the services that they have. They'll able to, offset some of the free options at lower speeds. If you don't like the service, for example, one of the options is to pay for additional services that get you to where you want to be. Otherwise, it might be a variety of advertising and other mechanisms. So it's one of those other reasons I always recommend when you are signing up for services, even though it can be challenging, taking a look at terms and conditions is always important, because that will also let you know how they might be using the data that you're supplying to them, which could mean they're also supplying that data to third parties and using that as a means to recoup some of those costs. Otherwise, it could be other traditional advertising mechanisms. So if you do, for example, sign up or need to install a VPN client on a mobile device, that might come with advertisements or other things that you'll basically need to, watch or listen to as a part of that process. But there's a variety of ways, not too different from how a variety of, quote-unquote, free services out there generate revenue.
Susan emailed a question, wonders if you could give your opinion of the quality or effectiveness of some online security and privacy products. She mentioned Google Authenticator, DuckDuckGo Browser, and LifeLock Security Service.
And I haven't used LifeLock myself. I know that it is popular for identity theft. One item I do note at least with any kind of identity theft, an important thing to do is also freeze your credit, which is a free thing that you can do. And you can do it with the three major credit agencies so that individuals can't request information from your credit report, but also that no one can take out credit in your name. It's an extremely important step outside of, you know, other monitoring solutions. You also may have those monitoring solutions that are built into your bank, or you might also be able to benefit from one of the three credit bureaus as well. So I think LifeLock could be a good option. I don't have personal experience with it. I do recommend freezing your credit and you know, keeping it frozen unless you really need it. It's really, really easy to unfreeze. And outside of yourself, I would recommend freezing your credit. If you do have children, freeze your credit for your children as well. There have been instances of individuals actually taking out credit in a child's name and then finding out when they turn 15, 16, 18, that they already have a variety of credit cards out and that their credit has been negatively impacted. So freezing the credit, not only of yourself, but of others in your family is extremely important just to protect, you know, identity and
sure,
that credit. So in terms of other services, DuckDuckGo, a lot of people do like for the privacy and anonymized browsing. A lot of people really, really enjoy using it, and it works for them. I would not recommend not using it. I don't use it too much myself, but there is a very good following in terms of using that kind of browser to help limit ads and other information that's being delivered. The challenge with a lot of websites out there is there are mechanisms to enable privacy, and a lot of websites just tend to ignore it. There's like technical like switches. You can say, hey, don't collect my data, don't share it. And a lot of the websites just don't apply that in a way that actually meets up to the expectation you probably have of not having your data shared or collected. And DuckDuckGo and other browsers can be extremely useful to do that. So
Google Authenticator?
Yeah, Google Authenticator. So there's a lot of authenticator apps out there. And we'll see this quite often with third-party services. It could be your bank. I think banks were very quick to turn this on. You'll see two-factor or multi-factor authentication. So outside of a password, you're proving who you are by what you have, which in this case could be a cell phone, and typing in a code that Google Authenticator would be giving you. Google Authenticator is a great service. It works with a variety of platforms, and it's worked really well for me. I've used it for years. So I definitely recommend it. Some of your services that you're going to be signing up for will have, they might want you to use a specific service. I think most of the time, Google Authenticator is usually on a list in terms of whether you're going to be able to use it. I use a variety of authenticator apps depending on the service that I'm using. So it does mean I'm switching from app to app depending on what I'm logging into. But I'd say for the most part, Google Authenticator is one of the most popular. So if you don't have it today, it's probably worth having there, because at some point in the future, it's very likely that you'll need to, because the service that they'll have available will be using the Google Authenticator. But there are other third-party services out there. Microsoft also has their own authenticator service, and it can be used for services outside of Microsoft. But Google Authenticator is very, very widely used. It's free, and it's available from your smartphone with a quick download.
John emailed us with a question. He wonders, well, he says, Windows 8.1 is no longer supported. Is there a free Windows 10 to upgrade to?
There was at one point. I do not know if that is still available. Most individuals that did get a free upgrade notification were able to take advantage of that. You'd actually get prompted just from Windows. Hey, by the way, would you like to upgrade to Windows 10? Here's how you can go ahead and take away of a free upgrade. Another way that you could go about just to see whether you could take advantage of the upgrade is at least checking Windows updates on your own system to see if you do have a prompt in order to be able to update to Windows 10. Some of the challenges, at least with updating right now, could be whether your hardware supports it. So usually with every new operating system that comes out there from Microsoft or from another vendor, does have additional prerequisites, or you need to meet these requirements before you can upgrade. That could be the only challenge with upgrading, is actually being able to meet that hardware requirement.
Yeah.
So you can do the update. I would recommend checking Windows updates on your computer. Usually it's going to show you, one, whether you do have updates available and whether they're installed. But if you do have that option to upgrade to Windows 10 or even Windows 11, it's likely going to tell you right in that area and give you instructions on how to do so, or how you can get that device updated.
Therese in Fort Atkinson emailed us, and she's lately noticed the tap to pay option on gas pumps. Is this payment option any more secure than using the card reader at the pump, or could a card skimmer still pick up the card's information?
Yeah, the tap-to-go, those pumps are generally safe. There are ways to try to receive some of that information. It does also depend on whether you're using a physical card versus using a mobile device. So a mobile device, if you're using like the Google Wallet or the Apple Wallet, they have a different way to store and replay some of that credit card information that makes it much more challenging, actually, to get that card data. It's not actually using your card data. It's generating kind of a random brand new card every time you make a transaction. So in some cases, using those applications is could potentially even be more secure than using a physical card. In those cases, I'd say using those tap to pay are relatively safe, assuming those devices themselves have not been tampered with. And that's usually the biggest challenge when going to any location. And that could also be, you know, for example, an ATM machine. One thing we have seen at a variety of locations in the past, and you hear stories, and you can do a quick Google search and probably see a few newscasts of individuals that have seen payment devices being tampered with. So they might put on their own extra reader, or they might replace or add onto a card reader at an ATM. And you'll see a variety of security mechanisms around that now to limit that effectiveness. You might have noticed weird bars that kind of cover the credit card slot in an ATM. That's to make sure no one can put on their own credit card reader so they can kind of read that information once you're inputting your credit card. So I'd say it is safe. The biggest thing to keep in mind whenever you use any kind of device that you're not familiar with, does it look like the other devices that are around you? If you touch it and move it a little bit, does it come off the machine? And usually there are a few of those checks that will at least help you make sure that it's not been tampered with. Hopefully the location is also doing this on a regular basis, just to make sure that their hardware has not been tampered with. But outside of that, the technology is relatively safe. It's over a short distance. And so the risk of trying to gather that information would be a little bit more challenging, unless, of course, that data was being collected by a different device and somehow being collected by a third party.
Jesse LeGrue, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here. A question about security, or another question just relating to your own computers or software. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Give a call, shoot an email, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Sometimes airports and other public places have free USB port charging stations. And those, I would assume, could pose some security threats. What's going on there? Juice jacking, I heard that term.
Yeah. Juice jacking is an interesting new way. Well, not new. It's been around for a little bit. But a lot of smartphones these days, when you plug it into a device, it's not just to charge it. It's also to use it as an external hard drive. You can transfer data to and from your device. And when you do plug in your, especially a smartphone, into a USB port, there's the capability somebody could do the same thing, but actually without you knowing it. Usually your device is going to tell you, hey, what would you like me to do when you plug this into USB? Would you like me to, you know, allow the use as an external hard drive or just to charge? But that is a risk. So if you do plug it into a USB port that you don't control or aren't aware of, there's the possibility somebody could use that to try and gather data from your phone, to install malware, or to do a variety of other things. Potential is also there if somebody wanted to try to damage your device, since you are plugging it into a potential power source that could do a variety of different things. Even for the USB ports that are supplied by, let's say, an airport, a bus station, whatever it might be, those can also kind of come into the same risk that we talked about with credit cards. People can put over, these USB ports, their own faceplate with their own USB ports that they could be using to make it look more legitimate, but you're actually not plugging it into the infrastructure that the airport or the other transportation utility is supplied. You're plugging it into a device that somebody else controls, and they might be able to try to gather data wirelessly or some other method. So one recommendation for anyone who's traveling and you need to charge your device, bring your own charger that has a power port that you can plug in to a wall plate. So that will at least minimize that possibility someone could be trying to gather data or make changes to your device when you plug into a USB port. That's unfortunately a risk, not just with ports that might be installed by a third party that appear legitimate, but even if you know the airport installed these USB ports for me to use, it could be uncertain whether somebody else has put their own fake faceplate on top of that, that is allowing them to collect data from you as well. And while I noted the fake, the using your own cable physical power, that is another point of using your own cable. So cables themselves can also be used to gather that information. So even if you do have your own power but are using somebody else's cable, there is the potential to actually use that cable to collect information and even transmit it wirelessly. And there are legitimate products you can purchase on the marketplace that do that relatively inexpensively, where just with that cable itself, you can transmit data wirelessly to a third party, only using that cable itself, even if you are plugged into a physical power. So that's, you know, kind of another risk. Make sure you have your own cable. Make sure it's, you know, legitimate in terms of meeting the standards of whatever the manufacturer is. Apple is really good about saying, if you do see this on the package or you see this on the cable, this is legitimate and it's safe to use. If it does not have those same markings, it may not be safe to use and you might want to consider using something else. So have your own cable, make sure it's legitimate if you're purchasing it from a third party and it meets the requirements of your phone manufacturer, and don't use USB ports, use physical power. So have that power adapter with that USB cable so you can power your device.
Let's take another call. Annette in Green Bay will go to you now. Hi, Annette. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. I have a question about VPN, and I hope you didn't talk to us about this. I wasn't hearing for a couple of minutes there. But what does VPN do with your emails? And does that also encrypt your location so that someone like Google or Gmail doesn't know your location? And the reason I'm asking that is because I send out some group emails, and some people get a message that says, beware of this email. We don't know anything about it. And is that because my IS or my address has been hidden from their knowledge?
That's a good question. So covering the email aspect of it first. So, you know, when you're on your normal internet connection on your cell phone and you send an email, and let's say it's from your, you know, normal internet service provider at home, in the email itself, once somebody looks at it on the other side, it will show information in terms of where you're connected from, what your IP address is, and potentially what your internet service provider is. So that information is tracked. It is available by that mail system, and it can usually be seen by the end user on the other side. Once you connect to a VPN, that information changes. So it's not that the information can't be tracked. The information will be, let's just say, less legitimate than it was otherwise. So you are still connecting from your internet service provider, but the data being supplied is really going to be from that virtual private network, that service that you're using to kind of protect your internet connection. Usually that's also going to be seen by that email provider, and it's also going to be seen by the end user on the other end. One odd thing that can kind of come up with that is if you are using, let's say, a corporate email service on your day-to-day work at home, it might look legitimate because, you know, you're logging in from whatever city and state that you're working in. If you connect to a VPN and let's say it's connected to Europe and you're not regularly in Europe, your email system and the end user might see, well, if they're coming from Europe, that's a little bit weird. And so that is an unusual thing that can happen with a virtual private network. It makes you look like you're in a location that you're not already in. Usually outside of that, there isn't going to be any other unusual artifacts, but that email will have that information kind of built into that kind of envelope once you submit it. So it'll know what IP address you're using. It'll know what internet service provider that you're using, and that'll go along with it. So it does basically mask where you are, but it will supply and forward along the information from the VPN service itself. There are also some other ways that your information might be tracked, let's say either by Google or by other services. One is by your internet connection, but one is also by GPS. And GPS, that is going to be the same either with your cellular network. So you actually will have kind of separate sets of data that are actually saying where you are, and they're going to be supplying it in different ways to different services. So your internet service provider, or in this case, it might be your VPN, will say, hey, I'm over here. This is my IP address. Your GPS may say, I'm in this location because I have access to these towers, and this is generally where I am. So that will actually tell something different. But your email system will only really see that one piece of it if it's using that VPN connection rather than the cellular data connection. And that's the other thing, is some applications are not very smart about which one to use. So if you do have a working cellular data connection and a functioning VPN connection, the question is, well, which one does your email application use once you hit send? And that could be different from, you know, your VPN settings. It could be different based on the device that you're using or from the application that you're using. I hate to say it depends, but it can be different depending on whether you have an active cellular connection at the same time. But your email provider will likely see a different connection and a different location and a different internet service provider than they would otherwise see if you did not have VPN connected. And usually they'll know this is from a VPN. That also might increase suspicion for the email provider of, this looks like an anonymized connection. Should I really trust this? That may or may not be forwarded to end users as well. Every email service is going to be a little bit different.
Annette, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jesse LeGrew, our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. I'm Larry Mueller for the IDS Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jesse LeGrew, as we talk with him about your computer, your software, your phone. And we've zeroed a bit on security, but other questions are welcomed as well. Josh in Eau Claire is up next. Let's go there. Josh, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hi there. Thanks, of course, too, for having the program. I just wanted to relate. A previous caller asked about upgrading to Windows 10, and there's a Lifehacker article that I successfully used to upgrade older machines, 7 or 8 licenses to Windows 10. It does require going into PowerShell and writing a script, so a little bit of know-how, but it's possible and works pretty seamlessly.
Ah, all right. Josh, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jeff and Nina, let's go to you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I'm concerned that my Facebook account has been hacked. It will not accept my password. I went in to change my password, and they said they would send me a code to this email address, which is not mine. My email is Yahoo, and this one is Hotmail. It won't let me do anything differently, so I'm not sure what I should do.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry you're kind of running through this. This is a difficult situation to be in. The only recommendation I can give is to continue your communication with Facebook and also to let them know that the email account that they do have on record is different. They should have information in terms of when that information was changed. This, unfortunately, is a common tactic that a bad actor will use when looking at a Facebook or another account that's compromised. Once they are able to break in with a password, they will change the email address. So any account password resets or other information gets redirected to them rather than directed to you. And contacting Facebook is and working with continuing to work with Facebook is the best thing you can do right now in order to try to maintain or regain access to your account and hopefully remove access from that individual.
So just go online to email Facebook, or I don't know if Jeff can even get in. Jeff, can you get into Facebook at all?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I've emailed them 3 times and they've never responded. I've tried to find a number I can call them at, and they do not have any kind of a customer service line on which you can call them. So I'm just running into a brick wall.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, there's at least there's not much else that most others are going to be able to do to help regain service. It's really going to be continuing to work with Facebook as you can. They don't, at least to my knowledge, have a phone number you can call. It's really, you know, digital communications, email particularly, or through the Facebook application, which, you know, in this case, you can't log into. So that's not really a usable option to try and help get access to your account. You could attempt to contact you know, local law enforcement, see if they have other suggestions. But it is likely working through Facebook to try and get information, try to see if they can help you regain access to your account is really the best thing that you can kind of do. And it's not a fun process.
No, it isn't. I wonder if you could start a new Facebook page and then use that to contact them about your other Facebook page.
Yeah, and that could be another good option. So at least you do have another communication mechanism. If you do decide to do that, I would recommend using an email account you haven't used with Facebook before. If they are able to regain access, there might be a challenge if they need to use your existing email account to restore access. But any way you can get in contact with Facebook to try to work through the process is really the best thing you can do, because they have all the capabilities in order to make sure you can get access to that account again.
Jeff, I'm sorry that you're going through this, but that's the best you can do, I think, is just to keep after them as much as possible. And I don't know what else to say on that. I wish we had more for you. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us at ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Somebody was wondering about steps you might want to take when you pair your phone with a rental car. Anything there?
Oh, that's actually, I never thought about that. So with a rental car, you have a couple different ways, or I guess any vehicle, you usually have two ways to connect to it. One is going to be via Bluetooth, and one is going to be physically plugged in with a USB cable. Physically plugged in is relatively straightforward. You really have no impact unless you actually plug into the device. It does bring up a question where if you don't trust that car yourself, if you haven't owned it, how safe is it to plug in your device? There are probably ways for somebody to get access to things and read data on your phone. It feels a little bit less likely, but it's probably more dangerous overall than using your own device you've owned for quite some time. Outside of that, I'd say it's probably relatively safe. One interesting thing to keep in mind when you do pair a Bluetooth device, you might have multiple drivers either with a rental or a vehicle that you own. Keep in mind what devices you do have paired with it. Sometimes, just like any computer or smartphone, they may not have a very good way of picking the proper device to connect to when you turn on that device. I have had this happen to me where I've turned on my vehicle. It's connected to a device somebody else is using. They also happen to be on a phone call, and all of a sudden I'm on that phone call and I don't want to be. So when you do connect your device, just be mindful of any other devices that are connected to it. If you are using a rental vehicle and are planning to use Bluetooth, I would recommend going into the Bluetooth settings, removing any other devices that are listed. They're usually going to have a quick delete all button. And once that's completed, then go ahead and pair your device. Once you're done with the rental vehicle, I'd actually go through the same process just to make sure that your device is removed so that in the off chance you happen to be in the same physical proximity as your device, it doesn't somehow connect to your phone. Outside of that, it's probably relatively safe to use a rental to connect in that way.
Jim in Menominee will go to you now. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a hardware question here. We recently upgraded our service from our phone company to a fiber optic system, and I am no longer in need of my my home router here. And I'm wondering if to make it more secure as I pass the router on to someone else who could use it, should I just press that reset button in the back, and will that reset the router to its original password, which is printed on a label on the bottom of the router, without having to reconnect it to the network?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quick answer is yes. Most routers have the same reset button or a similar reset button. All you should need to do is hit the button. Usually it's going to be for a certain amount of seconds. It will reset the entire router to defaults. If you do want to make sure it is reset, you can plug a device into it and try to log into the web interface without it being connected to the internet, just to verify that you're able to log in with that default password. Once you're able to do that, it's basically, validated that it is reset and you can log in with that that default username and password. Another recommendation, if you are going to hand it off to somebody else, one of the biggest benefits you can get from just about any device is keeping it updated. So if you do have a firmware update for that device or you haven't applied it recently, you may also want to consider updating the firmware for that device and resetting it to defaults. And usually you can download the latest firmware update from the vendor website, and you can actually update the router completely offline if it has that capability. Sometimes you do need to have it plugged into the internet, but otherwise that reset button's going to work fine. Just test the default username and password once it's reset to make sure it's been reset. And if you're able to, update the firmware.
Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Jesse LeGrew's our guest today, information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. Always good to have him with us. And he's going to be around until 12:30 today. You can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us. Email address ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we'll be back with Jesse. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking technology on the show today with our regular guest, Jesse LeGrew. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jesse's an information security architect in Madison College's Technology Services Group. He helps with designing, developing, and implementing security standards and protocols. So as we visit with Jesse, I hope you'll join in. What tech questions do you have? Love to have you part of the conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Deb in Menominee Falls next. Deb, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Jesse. Thanks for taking my call. I'm wanting to know if it's possible, if you're running up against the maximum memory on your regular computer and you get one of those external hard drives, can you easily or can you at all move over files from your Google, Gmail account? If you keep files from like subscriptions and just whatever. Can that be moved over, and how do you go about doing that if you can?
Yeah, good question. There are a few different ways to do it with Google services. I actually ran into this recently with photos, which tend to stay around forever. They do have something called Google Takeout. It's a way where you can archive a variety of data from your Google account, and then you can save that to a different location. And it could be photos, it could be items on Google Drive, it could be items through email. They do have that capability to archive that information. You can save it to an external zip file or something else and then store that in a different location. The other nice thing that it will give you is it will tell you how much storage that you're using for each particular Google services. So in many cases, email tends to be a little bit lower. A lot of things like photos tend to be a lot higher just because a lot of people do, take a lot of pictures. Your phone, especially if it's paired with Google services, may automatically upload those photos to Google Photos. So I would recommend taking a look there just to see what's using up the most space. If it does turn out it is something like Google Photos, I did run into this, so it's something I would recommend. If you do archive your Google Photos and then you go ahead and remove those different pictures from the Google Photos web interface, which takes a little bit of time, but it's not too bad. If you don't also remove it from a mobile device that is synchronizing that data to your Google services, you might find out all those photos just magically reappear. So if you do that, you either need to turn off the synchronization from your mobile device, or after you archive it, delete them from your Google device as well, because otherwise it's just going to upload and take up all of that space at the same time again. I had to do the same thing. I tried it twice and I realized, oh, well, it's just resynchronizing what I had on my device to begin with. I'll clear up both of those at the same time and, you get a lot more space. So you can, you know, easily store it to an external location. Just use that Google Takeout feature. They will have an option within Google once you're in your account, and it'll say Manage Storage, and it will show you what you're using and how to export the variety of different services that you have. And then after that's done, you can go ahead and delete those files from those different Google services. Just keep in mind what you may or may not be synchronizing with other devices, just in the event that it might fill up that space again. Otherwise, I know Google does have a minimal fee if you did want to increase your storage. And I think the next storage up from 15 gigabytes is 50 gigabytes, 50. And I think that's maybe a couple dollars a month. Otherwise, if you didn't want to pay for that, use that Google Takeout feature to export all of that media and then clear it up. And then you can use it, an external hard drive, flash drive, anywhere else you want to store it to make sure you have copies of it.
There you go, Deb. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Willem, he called but couldn't stay with us and says, in your phone settings, it gives you options about do not track as well, and other options. Sounds like you can always be tracked when you're using the internet. Is that the truth?
Yes. So, yeah, you can always be tracked to an extent. And I think that's one of the other reasons for using, you know, anonymized browsing services, of using virtual private networks. There is always some kind of data out there that can help to better understand maybe who you are and where you're connecting from. And for most of our mobile devices, you know, we're signing in with Google services, maybe we're signing in with Apple services, or maybe Microsoft services. All of those, you know, usually have a legitimate pairing to your name, what your email account is, and that data synchronized can also give another data point to potentially track you over time. So I have my phone, I have my email set up. I'm constantly checking my email, or my phone is doing it for me. I don't have to hit a button for it. But my email provider might know what IP addresses, what locations, and what networks I'm coming from, and at what dates and times. So in theory, they could probably even know when I'm traveling and where I'm traveling to. That data is always there, especially when you do have a lot of those services turned on. Using virtual private networks can help quite a bit, but you may not be able to have a VPN on all the time. And even if you can, it might be, something you have to purchase, because that's going to be a lot of VPN usage for a lot of time. The only, you know, recommendation I could give if you didn't really want anyone to track anything is to limit using built-in synchronization services on your devices, and only access email and other services using other techniques. It might be a web browser, it might be something else, because anything that's constantly running in the background will be basically giving your provider data points in terms of where you're connecting from, and other information, including, you know, GPS data. It's really, really hard to do that. So if you really want to be completely anonymous, it's going to be tricky. There's actually some great resources online to see about doing that, and people do it for a variety of reasons, especially if they feel, you know, there's life safety issues. So they want to make sure they can't be tracked, because, you know, it could be a life safety challenge. So take a look online. There's some great ways to do it. You can really go into the deep end on it, but you can do it. It does take a lot of work, but there's usually going to be a data point somewhere, and it's usually going to be network information, or it's going to be cellular data that can be utilized either to track your general activity because you're just connecting to the internet, or, you know, where you're located based on cellular data and GPS signals.
Kathy in Waupaca County emailed us. She recently replaced her MacBook Pro laptop with a Lenovo Windows laptop. When Kathy was using her MacBook, she backed up her files to a Samsung solid-state hard drive. And she's wondering if she needs to do anything special to start using that same external hard drive with her new Windows computer. Are there any formatting concerns? How does she make sure she saves the files she has on that hard drive?
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. So there would be some formatting concerns just because Mac OS and Windows, when they do back up, they're going to be reading external hard drives and using external hard drives differently. They have different what they call file formats. In order to make that external backup drive usable by Windows, it may need to wipe everything on that hard drive, which in your case, you might want to keep it just in case you want to restore it from a Mac or find a different way to back it up. You have a couple different options. If I was really, really paranoid about the data and I wanted to make sure I still had that backup, you might want to purchase a separate drive just to be used with your Windows device and keep that old backup hard drive in a safe location in case you ever needed it. That way, you know, you'd be relatively safe in case maybe you forgot or managed to not back up something from your previous laptop onto your new laptop. You always have that fallback if you really, really needed it. Another option would be to try and back up that external hard drive to a different location and then wipe it and reuse it for use with the backup services built into Windows. Either way, you're, you know, kind of storing that data in a different location. Granted, if you're relatively certain that all your data is successfully transferred to your new computer, if it is all there, you could, you know, reuse your existing drive, but it will wipe the data so you can use it with a new backup service. You do run into the potential challenge. What if your laptop breaks during that first backup? And that's, you know, the reason I always, you know, think I tend to be a little bit more paranoid buying another external hard drive or finding a different way to back up that existing backup. So if something weird happened, you have a different way to go back if something bad happened. But yeah, it will want you to wipe that existing drive because it won't be able to read it. And that's going to, you know, wipe your existing backup. So I'd probably recommend using a different drive or finding a different way to back up that drive. If you still have your old laptop, you might be more safe because you kind of already have an existing backup if that old laptop's still functioning and your data's still on there. So that could be another, you know, safety net in the event that you did wipe that hard drive.
Jeff emailed us a question. He wonders if there are preferred security software packages, and you know he mentions Norton, Windows, McAfee.
Yeah, so Microsoft has made a variety of positive changes to their Windows Defender platform over a decade, probably more than that, and it has become one of the best anti-malware applications out there. That being said, it is not 100%. So no software out there to help identify viruses or potential compromises are 100%. So there's usually going to be something that one product will find that another does not. And it's very challenging to know, well, which one's better. And there are tons and tons of articles out there that will argue this in a variety of different ways. I personally think that the Windows Defender platform built in is works really, really well. There are other third-party applications that can give you additional benefits, but I personally do like the Windows versions. There could be a reason to look into other products. One, if you feel that it offers some additional services to you that Windows does not. So for example, we've talked about VPNs or virtual private networks. That is something where you might have the capability to purchase VPN services and anti-malware or other services from a third party, and you might find a monetary benefit with that. Same thing goes with password managers and other security services. So that bundling could give you a benefit if you are looking for a different third party. Granted, I do just tend to use the built-in Defender because it does work extremely well, and you know, Microsoft has the benefit of having all the data, well, not all the data, so it's, but having a lot of information in terms of, what Windows devices are being seen as, malicious data is being transmitted and being analyzed by Microsoft. So in terms of just understanding the threat landscape, I think Microsoft is in a very good place, which puts their product in a very good place. But service bundling could be a reason to think about using one of those other third parties. So no perfect solution, but you have a lot of options. And if you do want another third party service, including VPN, you might see a benefit.
A listener called but couldn't stay with us. They're wondering if, Jesse, if you know of any scams on Facebook Marketplace where people contact a seller but are just trying to get their phone number or scam them. Aware of any of that kind of activity?
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself, but with just about any platform out there, there is somebody willing to take advantage of it to social engineer somebody on the other end. And really, they're trying to take advantage of someone's trust and gather either information they shouldn't have, or even try to, you know, potentially sell you something that doesn't really exist and try to take advantage of you in that way. So I have heard of that happening. I, even without, you know, seeing exact data, I would be extremely surprised if that was not happening today. That tends to happen on just about any platform that is out there, is there will be someone on the other end that's willing to use it to take advantage of somebody else on the other side. So whenever using any kind of social media or any service, when you're interacting with somebody else that you really don't know who they are, you can't easily prove who they are on the other side, you know, be careful about the information that you're giving. If you're selling something, you might also need to do some additional scrutiny to know, will they actually give me the money if I show up in a certain location? So there's a lot of just general safety issues. I'd say overall, they're smaller than the amount of legitimate commerce happening on the platform. But, you know, they do happen. So it is something to be careful of. And unfortunately, as we heard with an earlier caller, individuals' accounts do get compromised. So who you think you're talking to on the other end may be a compromised account that somebody else is using to try and take advantage of the potential trust of that account, because it has been around for quite some time. So you might be talking to someone you think you're talking to, and they're somebody else. So I would just recommend be careful and, you know, do as much checking as you can, but it's limited.
Yeah, and somebody else was actually wondering in relation to that earlier caller, what's the benefit to the person who steals the page, more, you know, your Facebook page? I mean, how do they monetize that?
Yeah, there are a few different ways that it could be used. One is to gather the data from the Facebook account itself. So once you have that Facebook account, you might be able to read off a variety of the data that the users already supplied to the platform. It could be birth date information, it could be photos, it could be other other data posts. But it does offer a unique, I hate to use the word opportunity, but it is for the bad actor, of trying to social engineer anyone on their contacts list, because they've been added as a friend, they are potentially a safe individual. And that might also be used to try to take advantage of other individuals in that friend list. And that's just, you know, a couple different instances. But having that, you know, quote unquote, trusted Facebook account allows you to do different things that a brand new account with, you know, no history and no friends just doesn't have. It's a very different look of legitimacy than a brand new account.
Somebody else wondered about websites. Websites can be, you know, quote, quote, secure as well. What does that mean? And how can people tell if a website is secure?
Yeah, that's also a challenging question these days. So, you know, the traditional wisdom was if you look on the address bar and you see HTTPS, that S meaning it's secure, and you see a little lock, that it is safe. And what it means is it's encrypted. So the data that you're sending to a third party or they're sending you, no one should be able to read that information. But that's all it means. It just means it's encrypted. It doesn't mean it's safe. So you could still be talking to somebody that is dangerous on the other end that could be trying to do something bad once you navigate to their website. It just tells you that the data is encrypted. That kind of encryption right now is actually relatively easy to get for free. It used to be something that you normally would have to pay for or have more proof of identity. It's very, very easy to get legitimate encryption or SSL certificates to make it look like it's a legitimate website. So it really just tells you if it's encrypted, but it may not tell you if the website itself is safe. There could be still be somebody on the other end that could be dangerous. And so, you know, when you click on a link in an email, it can be really dangerous. If you know, for example, an email should be coming from Facebook, go directly to the Facebook site itself by typing it in yourself or using a legitimate link. Because a lot of times you're going to see that information directly from the source rather than trusting a third party, because there's a lot of different ways to kind of fool the end user to thinking this is a safe place to go, even though it may not be the place you think it is.
Oh, there's always something. But I tell you what, Jesse, we had Kellen Sugarcamp send a note just to say how helpful this information has been. She's learning a lot that the airport stuff information for her was particularly useful and really interesting. So, so you made an impact today. With, I think, probably with her, but with a lot of other people as well. And I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's always fun, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much, Jesse. Jesse, of course, LeGrue is an information security architect, works out of Madison College's Technology Services Group, and for that group, he helps with designing, and they develop and they implement security standards and protocols. So he knows an awful lot, and it'll be great to have him back in a couple of months, and we'll do this all over again. Just looking ahead, tomorrow at this time on the Larry Mueller Show, we've got a French baker who has published a really cool book, and he shares his bread and pastry secrets and got some great bread recipes. Here, once again, the photography in that is wonderful. Jill says she's still tries once in a while to wipe the flour off the top of the cover of the book, but it's really part of the photograph. So we'll talk about baking bread tomorrow, and then we hear from a Door County school that's devoted to lifelong learning. All that tomorrow, beginning at 11 on the Larry Mueller Show. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.